Florida reaches 1 million coronavirus cases. Welcome to this Pledge Drive edition of Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Florida becomes the third state in the country to cross the million case threshold. How does our state's response compare to what's being done in California? Plus, artists are protesting the Cuban government's strict policies on free speech.
Decree 349 that represses artistic freedom in Cuba, essentially. It really restricts what artists can and can't do.
Will the protests lead to substantial change? Finally, stories from the Florida Keys, told through the eyes of our very own Nancy Klingener. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. And thank you for your support during our winter membership campaign. 1 million coronavirus cases. Florida recently became the third state in the country to surpass this grim milestone. It's a statistic we knew was coming. States across the country have taken a much different approach from each state to how they are dealing with the pandemic, with varying degrees of success in containing the virus. Back in April, I had the opportunity to co-report an episode of Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting with Marisa Lagos. Marisa is a correspondent for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk and co-hosts the weekly show and podcast Political Breakdown. I spoke with Marisa earlier this morning. This episode of Reveal first aired in June, 6 months ago. What are some of the most notable changes in how California has responded to the new surge?
Oh my gosh, Katie, it feels like that was a lifetime ago. It's hard to think back. I mean, you know, it's been a long sort of, it felt like it was a long summer. I mean, we did have a real flattening of the curve for a bit there. There was a lot of concern after, you know, at the time that the Reveal episode aired, we were worried about the protests and whether those could lead to surges. But the truth is, things were going relatively well here until the fall. I think the biggest change is that we haven't seen the kind of wide scale across the board lockdown like the governor and many county officials instituted at the beginning. I think they've tried to become more targeted about the way they approach this. You know, we have kind of had an ebb and flow of businesses opening and then forced to kind of scale back. But we haven't been told, like we were in March, stay home. Don't go out unless you need to. You know, the world out there feels a little more normal, although it's still kind of quieter than it was pre-pandemic. It's just not, it's not as I would say as much of a hammer as we saw in the spring.
And, you know, we should note there was an explosion of cases in Miami-Dade as well in July and August over that long summer, where, you know, those counties became the epicenter for the country and things slowed down a bit in September, but they're on the rise again now. Like you said, we've hit that fall explosion in cases here as well. And Florida, we've seen a much different approach across different municipalities, with Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties being much slower to reopen due to the high number of cases and the Democratic leadership in place. Did L.A. and San Francisco take a different approach than, say, a more rural area in California like Fresno?
Yeah, and I think this was one of the big changes. I mean, like I said, in the beginning, there was this kind of blanket approach. Everybody needs to shut down. We're going to decide. And then, you know, the governor especially started getting a lot of pushback from more rural areas, from places with, you know, smaller populations. I was just looking at the statistics, for example, in a place like Alpine County, our tiniest county in California. They don't even have a hospital there. They were super low rates all until the last month or two. And so I think that it did make sense in some ways that you saw a different approach across our very diverse and varied state. I mean, we're diverse both in like the demographics, but also the rural versus urban, suburban. And so, you know, a lot of what we've seen, I think, is a concentration of this in more urban areas because that's where people live. That's where services are provided.
Some of the things we discovered early on in states' divided responses: lack of coordination between politicians and health experts, lack of communication to the public. Has any of that really changed where you are?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I gotta say, every time we talk about this, that we do need to look at the top. And I think that a lot of that mixed messaging isn't necessarily the fault of, you know, state governors, although some have added to it. But it really came from the Trump administration and the mixed messages there. So I think within California, like if you live in a pretty Democratic city like I do in San Francisco, the messaging from our state and local officials has actually been pretty consistent over this pandemic. Our governor has had a pattern since the beginning of holding these very long, winding press conferences where he basically talks for like 45 minutes at the camera and then lets us ask a couple questions. So I can't complain about access, I guess I would say. Same in San Francisco at the local level, the mayor here has been pretty proactive in communicating.
And you paint a very different picture of what's going on in California than what we have going on here in Florida. Our governor, Ron DeSantis, gave his first public press conference since the November election just this week. And so, you know, Ron DeSantis has faced sharp criticism from Democratic leaders in the state who argued that he hasn't done enough to slow the spread of the virus. Governor Gavin Newsom in California, on the other hand, he's also faced sharp criticism, but it's been more for his personal actions. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I would say two things. I'll get to the French laundry dinner in a minute. But first, I will say he has criticism, but from the other side. What we have seen throughout this is a real pushback from conservatives. I mean, dozens of lawsuits filed challenging limits on church service, you know, attendance, things like that. A real pushback from Republicans, especially from more conservative, you know, lawmakers and local officials. So he has had that criticism. It's just been coming from the opposite side of DeSantis, saying he went too far, that he's kind of, you know, taken the economy, you know, taken public health over the economic considerations, and that that's actually hurt California more. But yes, Newsom was the first in now what's becoming a longer line of Democratic officials in California getting criticism for kind of not following their own guidance. Newsom, it came out a week or two ago in the San Francisco Chronicle that he actually went to a household dinner at a very shishi restaurant called the French Laundry in Napa. This was a birthday celebration for one of his top advisors, who's also a lobbyist. So he's been getting a lot of pushback for that. You know, he points out, and it turns out London Breed, San Francisco's mayor, went to a similar party at the same exact restaurant the next day, which just broke this week. And, you know, I think they're both getting a lot of grief from people who feel like they've been asked to really sacrifice a lot. And that even though the restaurant was open legally under state and local guidelines, that they just aren't setting a good example, that they've lost some of their moral authority. And so I don't think it's going to do necessarily, mortal damage to any of these politicians, but it's not the best look, especially when you think about the communications problem and just how we haven't had a good strategy as a nation for how we talk about this and how we convince the public that they need to take it seriously.
Part of what we looked at when you and I co-reported this reveal episode was how the virus unfolded in both states in the very beginning of this pandemic. And in the beginning, California was quicker and more strict to respond than Florida. Now that we've been reopening the economy and the cases have skyrocketed in both states. But if you look at the COVID numbers proportionate to population, California has done a much better job than Florida, especially considering testing. And so if you look at that, it's 3.2% of California's population has tested positive versus 4.7% of Florida's. Do state leaders consider their response effective so far?
That's an interesting question, Katie. I mean, I think that, I think that they have had this dual concern of both the political and the practical implications since the beginning. And what we saw was, you know, after that very strict lockdown in the spring, a real loosening of some of these restrictions. And you can see, if you look county by county, how even in smaller places where you don't have as much density, anytime you let up on these restrictions, cases start to climb, right? So the lockdown worked, but I think there was an acknowledgement here that it wasn't a long-term sustainable solution. I mean, remember during our reporting, Katie, like, Mayor Breed told me she thought at the beginning this would be maybe a 3-week, 4-week thing. So I think they feel like they've worked in the sense that when we have really instituted strict measures, we've seen the numbers go down. But I think the problem is you can't live like that for a year and a half.
What I want to ask you, one of the major changes coming into 2021 is going to be this new leadership on the federal level. And so I wonder, what conversations has the Newsom administration had with the Biden administration? Do we expect there to be an extensive coordination between the state and the federal government?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, this is the best news probably Newsom feels like he's gotten since the spring. I mean, California, like states across the country, you know, red, blue alike, are really struggling to pay for this pandemic. And I think that there's a hope that with, you know, depending on what happens in the Georgia Senate races, that we could see some more robust relief. So I think that that's one area where Newsom is really pushing hard, both with the lame duck session of Congress and the president at the end of his term, but looking forward to a Biden administration. I mean, Kamala Harris is the first Californian in years to be anywhere near the White House in that kind of capacity, the first vice president we've ever had from California. Obviously, her focus will not just be the state, but I think there's a real sense that both in terms of her and some of the staff and appointments that Biden is eyeing, that we might have a much better chance of at least convincing the federal government of our needs.
And that's in sharp contrast to Florida, where Governor DeSantis remains a staunch supporter of President Trump. And I wonder, how do you see politics surrounding coronavirus continuing to play out into the next year nationwide?
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately that we are such a divided nation that we will continue to see some of this, you know, split, these schisms between red and blue states. Although I think that as you've reported, when you get down to the local level, there's not nearly as much of that sort of disagreement, because a public health official, whether they're a Republican or Democrat, is interested in keeping the public safe.
That was Marisa Lagos, KQED's California Politics and Government Desk correspondent. If you want to listen back to our Reveal episode from earlier in the summer, you can visit that at our Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. Still to come, artists are protesting free speech in Havana. Could the Cuban government change its policies? But first, we are only able to provide you in-depth analysis on the coronavirus and analysis of Latin America through support from our listeners like you. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. And thank you for your support during this winter membership campaign. Over the weekend, the streets outside of the Ministry of Culture in Havana sounded very different than usual. Hundreds of Cuban artists and members of the public protested the government's actions towards free speech. These types of protests that are public are very unusual in Cuba. Even more unusual, the government initially suggested they were willing to hear their concerns in a private meeting. WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett spoke with me earlier this morning. Tim, what led the Cuban artists from the San Isidro movement to begin a hunger strike in the first place? What was their complaint against the government?
Well, most specifically, it has to do with the arrest of a Cuban rapper named Dennis Solis. He had the gall, you know, according to the regime, to post a video of Cuban police entering his home without a warrant and harassing him, essentially. And that upset the regime. They put him on trial for contempt earlier this month and sentenced him to 8 months in prison. That was what really sparked the protest we're seeing now. But the larger issue that is driving these protests is a law that was put into effect 2 years ago in Cuba called Decree 349 that represses artistic freedom in Cuba, essentially. It really restricts what artists can and can't do, what kind of works of art they can and can't show or exhibit or perform. It really essentially says that artists can be subject to penalties or even arrest for anything that the regime determines is sort of against the healthy social order in Cuba, anything that's counter-revolutionary, for example, or anything they determine is pornographic or unhealthy. It essentially just puts a lot of restrictions on what artists can and can't do in Cuba. And that's the larger thing that's driving these protests we're seeing.
And so this led to mass protests with hundreds of people. Why is it so uncommon to see this type of public protest in Havana?
What is unusual is that so many ordinary non-artist Cubans came out to protest with the artists and the journalists and the intellectuals who were complaining about lack of artistic expression, lack of free speech. And it is very unusual to see this sort of mass outburst among Cubans, A, to even develop, and B, to last as long as it has. But again, we're seeing the regime putting an end to this fairly quickly. But the real question is, despite the fact that the regime has been trying this week to suppress this, does this have staying power? And that's the big question that really hasn't been answered yet.
And this is a video from the Associated Press. Here's Fernando Perez, a film director that was participating in the protests.
It's been a long time since we lacked this kind of direct dialogue with young people. Now they're recovering the spontaneity I experienced in the 60s, and which has somehow lost. There is diversity, different criteria, and we have to listen to them and give them space in this nation.
Tim, what were the protests happening in Cuba during the 60s?
Well, it wasn't so much protests. I think what he's referring to there is the fact that in the early 60s, right after the revolution, Cuba did experience a measure of artistic freedom. And because it was in the regime's, in the revolution's favor, I think, to promote artistic freedom. And so in the 60s, and again, this was a worldwide phenomenon, you've got the Beatles, you've got Woodstock going on in the 60s, and there was a measure of that also, that sort of spirit in Cuba. It was short-lived, though, and I think what he's referring to is he exaggerates a little bit, I think, there, the measure of artistic freedom that Cuba experienced during the 60s, and by the time you get to the 70s, you see a lot of repression, a lot of crackdowns on artists who are considered counter-revolutionary. And that lasts through the 80s up until in the 90s when you see what's called the special period, when the Soviet Union collapsed and Cuba lost a lot of its revenue. And the regime had to concentrate more on economics rather than, you know, cracking down on artists. So since the 90s, we had seen more and more artistic freedom redeveloping in Cuba. And that decree that I talked about earlier, Decree 349, that President Miguel Díaz-Canel signed into effect 2 years ago, that essentially put an end to those two or three decades of artistic expression that was feeling more space in Cuba.
Well, and the Cuban government now suggested that they were willing to meet with the artists over the weekend. And then they quickly took back that promise on Sunday. So what was the justification?
I think they got spooked by the fact that this protest was drawing so many non-artists, non-journalist Cubans, just ordinary Cubans who they thought would just stay on the sidelines. And they saw that despite the fact they thought that they would just be sort of dealing with this narrow cohort of Cubans, the artists, the journalists, the intellectuals. But then they saw that this was a wider phenomenon. And as I said, I think that spooked them. And they pulled back quite quickly. And President Díaz-Canel then on Sunday started making all these tweets, accusations against the artists that they were just puppets of the United States, and that they were, that their interests were not the interests of the Cuban Revolution, etc. And this is a playbook we see the Cuban regime pull out time and time again. They'll sort of indulge something just briefly, but then as soon as they begin to feel that it's maybe getting a little too widespread, a little too out of line, then they crack down on it. So this is a very common phenomenon in Cuba.
Do you think that's in normal brief political theater, or, you know, because these protests also blew up on social media and gathered international attention, did this give a different signal?
Yes, I mean, you said that the key word right there, social media. Let's not forget, this is not the first mass protest that we've seen in the past couple of years in Cuba to spook the regime like this. A couple of years ago, we saw a social media-based protest called Bajo el Precio del Internet, which means lower the price of the internet. The regime in the past few years has been allowing more internet access to Cubans, but it's still very expensive, that access. And so there was this protest a couple years ago that was really quite effective, that again drew just ordinary Cubans, not intellectuals and artists or tech folks. This was something that struck a chord with many Cubans. And the government let that play itself out for quite a while, surprisingly, to those of us who watch Cuba. And I think they felt that we shouldn't have let that run as long as it did back then. And so they didn't want this protest to become like that one, I think.
How do you expect the U.S.-Cuba relations to change under the Biden administration?
Well, I think Joe Biden has said that he will return to a lot of President Obama's policies of engagement with Cuba. I think he'll let Americans return to visiting Cuba, and I think you'll see more engagement between the U.S. government and the Cuban government. But what he's got to be, what Biden has to be careful about, though, is this feeling, not just amongst Cuban exiles here in Miami, but I think also in Washington, that the engagement that President Obama put in place just didn't turn out to be a two-way street. There's this feeling that we gave a lot of concessions to Cuba during that normalization of relations that President Obama presided over, but we didn't get a lot in return in terms of any kind of democratic reforms and kinds of in terms of any bilateral cooperation on the part of the Cubans. So I think you'll see President Biden, when he becomes president, he will return to that engagement policy, but I think he'll be doing it a lot more carefully and with a lot more demands that the Cuban government start giving a little as well.
Given how poorly the Democratic Party's performed among Latino voters in South Florida just a few weeks ago, is there a danger in taking this policy approach?
There is, and I think this goes back to what we were just talking about. I think this is something else that Joe Biden will have to be very mindful of. I think one of the other things, the other mistakes that President Obama made when he was engaging with the Cuban regime was that he didn't engage strongly enough with the Cuban exile community here at the same time. There's this feeling here that perhaps the Cuban exiles were not allowed to give their input into how this engagement policy should be pursued. And I think you'll see Joe Biden, or at least we should, if he wants this to be successful, I think we should see, politically successful anyway, I think we'll see Joe Biden engage the Miami exile community here as much as he's going to engage the Cuban regime and get their input.
WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett. We have more from the Miami Herald on the ongoing protests in Cuba over at WLRN.org. Still to come, stories from the Florida Keys from our very own Nancy Klingener. She tells us about the tie line. We'll get to Nancy in a moment, but first, a reminder that this is our winter membership campaign, and shows like Sundial, the South Florida Roundup, and the Sunshine Economy don't happen for free. They happen because of listeners like you. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support during our winter membership campaign. From keeping track of COVID numbers to getting in the holiday spirit Keys style, that's what you get with WLRN's Keys newsletter, called The Tie Line. It's a letter from Key West, penned twice a month by our very own southernmost reporter, Nancy Klingener. The most recent newsletter is continuing an end-of-year WLRN tradition where we ask you to share your weird Florida stories, like that time an opossum broke into a liquor store but got too drunk to get out. This year's been weird enough, so we want to hear instead about the moments that brought you joy in the midst of so much tragedy and uncertainty. Share your stories of joy with us on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You can also find a link there to sign up for our newsletters. Joining us now is WLRN Keys reporter and author of the Tideline newsletter, Nancy Klinginer. Welcome, Nan.
Hey, Katie.
Nope. Nan, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you not hear me?
Hi, welcome. Now, you sound great. What inspired you to start this newsletter?
Our other Katie Lepre, our engagement editor, I guess really inspired me to start it. But once I got in there, it sort of became almost a throwback to my very first radio stories, which were not news stories, but essays, a letter from Key West talking about things happening here and just offering a little context.
And so your very first letter from Key West was about the city's holiday parade back in 2009. Take us back to that time. What makes this parade so special?
Yeah, the parade was actually started back in the 90s when a ministerial association was having a holiday parade and did not want to let one of our local churches that has specific outreach to the LGBTQ community into their parade. And so the city, when they heard about that, said, well, you know, forget that. We are going to hold a holiday parade, and it is all inclusive, and it has just become this incredible local tradition. And, you know, a lot of our parades, like Fantasy Fest and stuff, are kind of like a tourism-gauged event, and this is purely local, and it's so much fun. And you've got the high school marching band, and you've got, you know, kids doing gymnastics, and all the local like utilities make these incredible floats, and Santa comes along in a fishing boat at the end. It's excellent.
It almost sounds like Key West becomes a little bit more of a small town feel at the holidays.
Yeah. It definitely feels that way. And you know, we have friends that we get together with every year. They live like a couple blocks from the parade route. So, you know, they have a little party and then we go watch the parade and get together with the same people every year at the same spot. And I think a lot of people do that.
Well, this year, because of COVID, the parade was canceled. What are you going to miss the most?
I think I will just miss seeing those friends in that place, you know, and I've seen their kids grow up over the years doing this. They throw candy from these floats, too. That's an important element. So it's a big hit with the kids. It's like a second Halloween almost. And I will really miss that. And also just seeing what kind of floats different groups come up with.
Well, you also shared that you're ready to go berserk with the holiday decorations this year to kind of make up for that. Are you planning anything special?
I think this year our big addition will be a bike frame up on the roof of our front porch with lights on it. That's the plan.
Very fun. Besides the fun of your own personal updates that you get to include in this newsletter, you also get to include news, which, of course, right now includes COVID. How are things on the island with the virus right now?
Not good. Not good at all. Our rates are pretty high, below 10% now in the last week or so, which is good, but definitely way higher than anyone would like to see them.
Well, you've been living in the Keys for almost 30 years now, Nan. In the most recent newsletter, you talk about the beginning of your journalism career. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I came down here in 1991 as a reporter for the Miami Herald. Back then, there was a special Keys edition for the Herald, and they had a two-reporter bureau. And so I got to cover pretty much everything in the Keys and spent a lot of time driving up and down the overseas highway. And sometimes if you were covering, say, a county commission meeting in Key Largo, you would have to file from the road. And this was, you know, before really the internet hadn't really taken hold yet, way before cell phones or anything like that. So it was kind of an interesting adventure at times.
Well, finally, our end of the year WLRN tradition. We usually ask people to share their weirdest Florida story. What are some of the weirdest stories you can recall from years past? Does it include anyone named Frank the Tree?
It's Fred the Tree. Fred the Tree.
Oh, Fred! Fred the Tree.
Yeah, that's a Australian pine on the old 7 Mile Bridge. It's growing up in a crack in the bridge, and every year it gets lit up by a series of anonymous elves, and becomes a Christmas tree. And you get to see it when you're driving down the Keys. It's really cool.
I love that, tree vigilantes. But this year, WLRN's doing something a little different, right?
Yeah. You know, those weird Florida compendiums are lots of fun. And obviously, Florida offers up lots of material for that. But it just seems like, do we really need to go there this year? Haven't we all just had enough weird news? And it seems like we should think about the things that did bring us joy this year, because there were some, and they were especially important, I think.
What's yours?
Well, the first one that came to my mind was a story I did early in the pandemic about a couple here in Key West, Lizzie and Celine. And I just saw this post from Lizzie on Facebook that said, we're getting married. Our family and friends can't come from around the country or the world like they were going to, because Celine is French. And the best way for them to sort of be there and take part remotely is YouTube Live. And to get a YouTube Live account, you need like 1,000 followers. And she's like, I have 2 followers. So I was like, wow. And I talked to them about it, and they were just so thoughtful and sweet and lovely, and wanting to be able to share their marriage with their friends all over the world and family.
And I have to admit, a pandemic wedding of my own has brought me the most joy in 2020. And it's been really nice to see how the world's coming together for these milestones.
Yeah, that was really lovely.
Thank you, WLRN's Nancy Klingener. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Katie.
You can find the link to sign up for our newsletters, including the Tie Line, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for Wednesday, December 2nd. Coming up tomorrow on our program, a conversation with Congressman Ted Deutsch about the Biden transition of power and the House's push for coronavirus relief. If you have a question for the congressman, email us at sundial@wlrnnews.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Plus, we'll speak with Sheriff Gregory Tony in Broward County about a new task force that's meant to hold police accountable, and we'll get his take on the, quote, bad apples theory. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz. Thank you so much for listening. Please continue to show your support for programs like Sundial